But, he did not remain there long, for, the Duke of Buckingham with a tender face made a speech expressing how anxious he was for the royal boy at EMS safety, and how much safer he would be in the Tower until his coronation, than he could be anywhere else. So, to the Tower he was taken, very carefully, and the Duke of Gloucester was named Protector of the State. Although Gloucester had proceeded thus far with a very smooth countenance, and although he was a clever man, fair of speech, and not ill-looking, in spite of one of his shoulders being something higher than the other, and although he had come into the city riding bareheaded at the King of TMS side, and looking very fond of Hema, he had made the King of TMS mother more uneasy yet, and when the royal boy was taken to the Tower, she became so alarmed that she took sanctuary in Westminster with her five daughters. Nor did she do this without reason, for, the Duke of Gloucester, finding that the lords who were opposed to the Woodville family were faithful to the young king nevertheless, quickly resolved to strike a blow for himself. Accordingly, while those lords met in council at the Tower, he and those who were in his interest met in separate council at his own residence, Crosby Palace, in Bishopsgate Street. Being at last quite prepared, he one day appeared unexpectedly at the council in the Tower, and appeared to be very jocular and merry. He was particularly gay with the Bishop of Ely, praising the strawberries that grew in his garden on Holborn Hill, and asking him to have some gathered that he might eat them at dinner. The Bishop, quite proud of the honour, sent one of his men to fetch some, and the Duke, still very jocular and gay, went out, and the council all said what a very agreeable duke he was. In a little time, however, he came back quite altered and not at all jocular, a frowning and fiercer, and suddenly said, Ay, what do those persons deserve who have compassed my destruction, I being the King of TMS lawful, as well as natural, protector? ATM. To this strange question, Lord Hastings replied, that they deserved death, whosoever they were. ATM, said the Duke, I tell you that they are that sorceress my brother at EMS wife semicolon ATM meaning the Queen, and that other sorceress, Jane Shore, who, by witchcraft, have withered my body, and caused my arm to shrink as I now show you. ATM. He then pulled up his sleeve and showed them his arm, which was shrunken, it is true, but which had been so, as they all very well knew, from the hour of his birth. Jane Shore, being then the lover of Lord Hastings, as she had formerly been of the late king, that lord knew that he himself was attacked. So, he said, in some confusion, I certainly, my lord, if they have done this, they be worthy of punishment. ATM. If. ATM, said the Duke of Gloucester, do you talk to me of ifs? I tell you that they have so done, and I will make it good upon thy body, thou traitor. ATM. With that, he struck the table a great blow with his fist. This was a signal to some of his people outside to cry at reason. ATM, they immediately did so, and there was a rush into the chamber of so many armed men that it was filled in a moment. First, ATM, said the Duke of Gloucester to Lord Hastings, I arrest thee, traitor. And let him, ATM, he added to the armed men who took him, have a priest at once, for by St. Paul I will not dine until I have seen his head off. ATM. Lord Hastings was hurried to the green by the Tower Chapel, and the beheaded on a log of wood that happened to be lying on the ground. Then, the Duke dined with a good appetite, and after dinner summoning the principal citizens to attend him, told them that Lord Hastings and the rest had designed to murder both himself and the Duke of Buckingham, who stood by his side, if he had not providentially discovered their design. He requested them to be so obliging as to inform their fellow citizens of the truth of what he said, and issued a proclamation, prepared and neatly copied out beforehand, to the same effect. On the same day that the Duke did these things in the Tower, Sir Richard Ratcliffe, the boldest and most undaunted of his men, went down to Pontefract, arrested Lord Rivers, Lord Grey, and two other gentlemen, and publicly executed them on the scaffold, without any trial, for having intended the Duke at EMS death. 3 days afterwards, the Duke, not to lose time, went down the river to Westminster in his barge, attended by divers bishops, lords, and soldiers, and demanded that the Queen should deliver her second son, the Duke of York, into his safekeeping. The Queen, being obliged to comply, resigned the child after she had wept over him, and Richard of Gloucester placed him with his brother in the Tower. Then, he seized Jane Shaw, and, because she had been the lover of the late king, confiscated her property, and got her sentenced to do public penance in the streets by walking in a scanty dress, with bare feet, and carrying a lighted candle, to St. Paul at EMS Cathedral, through the most crowded part of the city. Having now all things ready for his own advancement, he caused a friar to preach a sermon at the cross which stood in front of St. Paul at EMS Cathedral, in which he dwelt upon the profligate manners of the late king, and upon the late shame of Jane Shore, and hinted that the princes were not his children. Whereas, good people, atm said the friar, whose name was Shore, my lord the protector, the noble Duke of Gloucester, that sweet prince, the pattern of all the noblest virtues, is the perfect image and express likeness of his father. Atm there had been a little plot between the Duke and the friar, that the Duke should appear in the crowd at this moment, when it was expected that the people would cry, long live King Richard. Atm but, either through the friar saying the words too soon, or through the Duke Atm's coming too late, the Duke and the words did not come together, and the people only laughed, and the friar sneaked off ashamed. The Duke of Buckingham was a better hand at such business than the friar, so he went to the Guildhall the next day, and addressed the citizens in the Lord Protector at EMS behalf. A few dirty men, who had been hired and stationed there for the purpose, crying when he had done, God save King Richard. Atm he made them a great bow, and thanked them with all his heart. Next day, to make an end of it, he went with the mayor and some lords and citizens to Bayard Castle, by the river, where Richard then was, and read an address, humbly entreating him to accept the crown of England. Richard, who looked down upon them out of a window and pretended to be in great uneasiness and alarm, assured them there was nothing he desired less, and that his deep affection for his nephews forbade him to think of it. To this the Duke of Buckingham replied, with pretended warmth, that the free people of England would never submit to his nephew Atm's rule, and that if Richard, who is the lawful heir, refused the crown, why then they must find someone else to wear it. The Duke of Gloucester returned, that since he used that strong language, it became his painful duty to think no more of himself, and to accept the crown. Upon that, the people cheered and dispersed, and the Duke of Gloucester and the Duke of Buckingham passed a pleasant evening, talking over the play they had just acted with so much success, and every word of which they had prepared together. Chapter 6 England under Richard III. King Richard III was up betimes in the morning, and went to Westminster Hall. In the hall was a marble seat, upon which he sat himself down between two great noblemen, and told the people that he began the new reign in that place, because the first duty of a sovereign was to administer the laws equally to all, and to maintain justice. He then mounted his horse and rode back to the city, where he was received by the clergy and the crowd as if he really had a right to the throne, and really were a just man. The clergy and the crowd must have been rather ashamed of themselves in secret, I think, for being such poor-spirited knaves. The new king and his queen were soon crowned with a great deal of show and noise, which the people liked very much, and then the king set forth on a royal progress through his dominions. He was crowned a second time at York, in order that the people might have show and noise enough, and wherever he went was received with shouts of rejoicing from a good many people of strong lungs, who were paid to strain their throats in crying, God save King Richard. Atm the plan was so successful that I am told it has been imitated since, by other usurpers, in other progresses through other dominions. While he was on this journey, King Richard stayed a week at Warwick, and from Warwick he sent instructions home for one of the wickedest murders that ever was done, the murder of the two young princes, his nephews, who were shut up in the Tower of London. Sir Robert Brackenbury was at that time governor of the Tower. To him, by the hands of a messenger named John Green, did King Richard send a letter, ordering him by some means to put the two young princes to death. But Sir Abertu, I hope, because he had children of his own, and loved Thema, sent John Green back again, riding and spurring along the dusty roads, with the answer that he could not do so horrible a piece of work. The king, having frowningly considered a little, called to him Sir James Dirrell, his master of the horse, and to him gave authority to take command of the tower, whenever he would, for 24 hours, and to keep all the keys of the tower during that space of time. Tyrrell, well knowing what was wanted, looked about him for 2 hardened ruffians, and chose John Dighton, one of his own grooms, and Miles Forrest, who was a murderer by trade. Having secured these 2 assistants, he went, upon a day in August, to the tower, showed his authority from the king, took the command for 24 hours, and obtained possession of the keys. And when the black night came, he went creeping, like a guilty villain as he was, up the dark, stone-winding stairs, and along the dark stone passages, until he came to the door of the room where the 2 young princes, having said their prayers, lay fast asleep, clasped in each other at Thema's arms. And while he watched and listened at the door, he sent in those evil demons, John Dighton and Miles Forrest, who smothered the 2 princes with the bed and pillows, and carried their bodies down the stairs, and buried them under a great heap of stones at the staircase foot. And when the day came, he gave up the command of the tower, and restored the keys, and hurried away without once looking behind him, and Sir Robert Brackenbury went with fear and sadness to the Prince at Thema's room, and found the princes gone forever. You know, through all this history, how true it is that traitors are never true, and you will not be surprised to learn that the Duke of Buckingham soon turned against King Richard, and joined a great conspiracy that was formed to dethrone him, and to place the crown upon its rightful owner at Thema's head. Richard had meant to keep the murder secret, but when he heard through his spies that this conspiracy existed, and that many lords and gentlemen drank in secret to the healths of the 2 young princes in the tower, he made it known that they were dead. The conspirators, though thwarted for a moment, soon resolved to set up for the crown against the murderous Richard, Henry Earl of Richmond, grandson of Catherine, that widow of Henry V who married Owen Tudor. And as Henry was of the House of Lancaster, they proposed that he should marry the Princess Elizabeth, the eldest daughter of the late king, now the heiress of the House of York, and thus by uniting the rival families put an end to the fatal wars of the Red and White Roses. All being settled, a time was appointed for Henry to come over from Brittany, and for a great rising against Richard to take place in several parts of England at the same hour. On a certain day, therefore, in October, the revolt took place, but unsuccessfully. Richard was prepared, Henry was driven back at sea by a storm, his followers in England were dispersed, and the Duke of Buckingham was taken, and at once beheaded in the marketplace at Salisbury. The time of his success was a good time, Richard thought, for summoning a parliament and getting some money. So, a parliament was called, and it flattered and fawned upon him as much as he could possibly desire, and declared him to be the rightful King of England, and his only son Edward, then 11 years of age, the next heir to the throne. Richard knew full well that, let the Parliament say what it would, the Princess Elizabeth was remembered by people as the heiress of the House of York, and having accurate information besides, of its being designed by the conspirators to marry her to Henry of Richmond, he felt that it would much strengthen him and weaken them, to be beforehand with them, and marry her to his son. With this view he went to the sanctuary at Westminster, where the late King of Thema's widow and her daughter still were, and besought them to come to court, where, he swore by anything and everything, they should be safely and honourably entertained. They came, accordingly, but had scarcely been at court a month when his son died suddenly or was poisoned and his plan was crushed to pieces. In this extremity, King Richard, always active, thought, I must make another plan. Thema, and he made the plan of marrying the Princess Elizabeth himself, although she was his niece. There was one difficulty in the way, his wife, the Queen Anne, was alive. But, he knew, remembering his nephews, how to remove that obstacle, and he made love to the Princess Elizabeth, telling her he felt perfectly confident that the Queen would die in February. The princess was not a very scrupulous young lady, for, instead of rejecting the murderer of her brothers with scorn and hatred, she openly declared she loved him dearly, and, when February came and the Queen did not die, she expressed her impatient opinion that she was too long about it. However, King Richard was not so far out in his prediction, but, that she died in March, he took good care of that, and then this precious pair hoped to be married. But they were disappointed, for the idea of such a marriage was so unpopular in the country, that the King of TM's chief counsellors, Ratcliffe and Catesby, would by no means undertake to propose it, and the King was even obliged to declare in public that he had never thought of such a thing. He was, by this time, dreaded and hated by all classes of his subjects. His nobles deserted every day to Henry at TM's side. He dared not call another parliament, lest his crimes should be denounced there, and for want of money, he was obliged to get benevolences from the citizens, which exasperated them all against him. It was said too, that, being stricken by his conscience, he dreamed frightful dreams, and started up in the night time, wild with terror and remorse. Active to the last, through all this, he issued vigorous proclamations against Henry of Richmond and all his followers, when he heard that they were coming against him with a fleet from France, and took the field as fierce and savage as a wild boar or the animal represented on his shield. Henry of Richmond landed with 6,000 men at Milford Haven, and came on against King Richard, then encamped at Leicester with an army twice as great, through North Wales. On Bosworth Field the two armies met, and Richard, looking along Henry at TM's ranks, and seeing them crowded with the English nobles who had abandoned him, turned pale when he beheld the powerful Lord Stanley and his son, whom he had tried hard to retain, among them. But, he was as brave as he was wicked, and plunged into the thickest of the fight. He was riding hither and thither, laying about him in all directions, when he observed the Earl of Northumberland, one of his few great Alyssa, to stand inactive, and the main body of his troops to hesitate. At the same moment, his desperate glance caught Henry of Richmond among a little group of his knights, riding hard at him, and crying "A treason! A TM!" He killed his standard bearer, fiercely unhorsed another gentleman, and aimed a powerful stroke at Henry himself, to cut him down. But, Sir William Stanley parried it as it fell, and before Richard could raise his arm again, he was borne down in a press of numbers, unhorsed, and killed. Lord Stanley picked up the crown, all bruised and trampled, and stained with blood, and put it upon Richmond at TM's head, amid loud and rejoicing cries of "A long live King Henry!" ATM, that night, a horse was led up to the Church of the Grey Friars at Leicester, across whose back was tied, like some worthless sack, a naked body brought there for burial. It was the body of the last of the Plantagenet line, King Richard III, usurper and murderer, slain at the Battle of Bosworth Field in the 32nd year of his age, after a reign of 2 years. Chapter 6 View England under Henry VII. King Henry VII did not turn out to be as fine a fellow as the nobility and people hoped, in the first joy of their deliverance from Richard III. He was very cold, crafty, and calculating, and would do almost anything for money. He possessed considerable ability, but his chief merit appears to have been that he was not cruel when there was nothing to be got by it. The new king had promised the nobles who had espoused his cause that he would marry the Princess Elizabeth. The first thing he did, was, to direct her to be removed from the castle of Sheriff Hutton in Yorkshire, where Richard had placed her, and restored to the care of her mother in London. The young Earl of Warwick, Edward Plantagenet, son and heir of the late Duke of Clarence, had been kept a prisoner in the same old Yorkshire castle with her. This boy, who was now 15, the new king placed in the Tower for safety. Then he came to London in great state, and gratified the people with a fine procession, on which kind of show he often very much relied for keeping them in good humour. The sports and feasts which took place were followed by a terrible fever, called the sweating sickness, of which great numbers of people died. Lord Mayors and Aldermen are thought to have suffered most from it, whether because they were in the habit of overeating themselves, or because they were very jealous of preserving filth and nuisances in the city, as they have been since, I don't yet know. The King of TM's coronation was postponed on account of the general ill health, and he afterwards deferred his marriage, as if he were not very anxious that it should take place, and, even after that, deferred the Queen of TM's coronation so long that he gave offence to the York party. However, he set these things right in the end, by hanging some men and seizing on the rich possessions of others, by granting more popular pardons to the followers of the late king than could, at first, be got from him, and by employing about his court some very scrupulous persons who had been employed in the previous reign. As this reign was principally remarkable for two very curious impostures which have become famous in history, we will make those two stories its principal feature. There was a priest at Oxford of the name of Simons, who had for a pupil a handsome boy named Lambert Simnel, the son of a baker. Partly to gratify his own ambitious ends, and partly to carry out the designs of a secret party formed against the king, this priest declared that his pupil, the boy, was no other than the young Earl of Warwick, who, as everybody might have known, was safely locked up in the Tower of London. The priest and the boy went over to Ireland, and, at Dublin, enlisted in their cause all ranks of the people, who seemed to have been generous enough, but exceedingly irrational. The Earl of Kildare, the governor of Ireland, declared that he believed the boy to be what the priest represented, and the boy, who had been well tutored by the priest, told them such things of his childhood, and gave them so many descriptions of the royal family, that they were perpetually shouting and hurrahing, and drinking his health, and making all kinds of noisy and thirsty demonstrations, to express their belief in him. Nor was this feeling confined to Ireland alone, for the Earl of Lincoln, whom the late usurper had named as his successor, went over to the young pretender, and, after holding a secret correspondence with the Dowager Duchess of Burgundy, the sister of Edward IV, who detested the present king and all his race, he sailed to Dublin with 2,000 German soldiers of her providing. In this promising state of the boy at TM's fortunes, he was crowned there, with a crown taken off the head of a statue of the Virgin Mary, and was then, according to the Irish custom of those days, carried home on the shoulders of a big chieftain possessing a great deal more strength than sense. Father Simons, you may be sure, was mighty busy at the coronation. 10 days afterwards, the Germans, and the Irish, and the priest, and the boy, and the Earl of Lincoln, all landed in Lancashire to invade England. The king, who had good intelligence of their movements, set up his standard at Nottingham, where vast numbers resorted to him every day, while the Earl of Lincoln could gain but very few. With his small force he tried to make for the town of Newark, but the King of TM's army getting between him and that place, he had no choice but to risk a battle at Stoke. It soon ended in the complete destruction of the pretender at TM's forces, one half of whom were killed, among them, the Earl himself. The priest and the baker at TM's boy were taken prisoners. The priest, after confessing the trick, was shut up in prison, where he afterwards died suddenly perhaps. The boy was taken into the King of TM's kitchen and made a turnspit. He was afterwards raised to the station of one of the King of TM's falconers, and so ended this strange imposition. There seems reason to suspect that the Dowager Queen, always a restless and busy woman, had some share in tutoring the baker at TM's son. The king was very angry with her, whether or no. He seized upon her property, and shut her up in a convent at Bermondsey. One might suppose that the end of this story would have put the Irish people on their guard, but they were quite ready to receive a second impostor, as they had received the first, and that same troublesome Duchess of Burgundy soon gave them the opportunity. All of a sudden there appeared at Cork, in a vessel arriving from Portugal, a young man of excellent abilities, of very handsome appearance and most winning manners, who declared himself to be Richard, Duke of York, the second son of King Edward IV. "Ao, ATM," said some, even of those ready Irish believers, but surely that young prince was murdered by his uncle in the Tower. "Ate mat is supposed so, ATM said the engaging young man, A and my brother was killed in that gloomy prison, but I escape A do it don't you TMT matter how, at present two and have been wandering about the world for 7 long years. ATM this explanation being quite satisfactory to numbers of the Irish people, they began again to shout and to hurrah, and to drink his health, and to make the noisy and thirsty demonstrations all over again. And the big chieftain in Dublin began to look out for another coronation, and another young king to be carried home on his back. Now, King Henry being then on bad terms with France, the French king, Charles VIII, saw that, by pretending to believe in the handsome young man, he could trouble his enemy sorely. So, he invited him over to the French court, and appointed him a bodyguard, and treated him in all respects as if he really were the Duke of York. Peace, however, being soon concluded between the two kings, the pretended duke was turned adrift, and wandered for protection to the Duchess of Burgundy. She, after feigning to inquire into the reality of his claims, declared him to be the very picture of her dear departed brother, gave him a bodyguard at her court, of 30 halberdiers, and called him by the sounding name of the White Rose of England. The leading members of the White Rose party in England sent over an agent, named Sir Robert Clifford, to ascertain whether the White Rose ATM's claims were good. The king also sent over his agents to inquire into the Rose ATM's history. The White Roses declared the young man to be really the Duke of York, the king declared him to be Perkin Warbeck, the son of merchant of the city of Tournai, who had acquired his knowledge of England, its language and manners, from the English merchants who traded in Flanders. It was also stated by the royal agents that he had been in the service of Lady Brompton, the wife of an exiled English nobleman, and that the Duchess of Burgundy had caused him to be trained and taught, expressly for this deception. The king then required the Archduke Philippe, who was the sovereign of Burgundia, to banish this new pretender, or to deliver him up, but, as the Archduke replied that he could not control the Duchess in her own land, the king, in revenge, took the market of English cloth away from Antwerp, and prevented all commercial intercourse between the two countries. He also, by arts and bribes, prevailed on Sir Robert Clifford to betray his employers, and he denouncing several famous English noblemen as being secretly the friends of Perkin Warbeck, the king had three of the foremost executed at once. Whether he pardoned the remainder because they were poor, I do not know, but it is only too probable that he refused to pardon one famous nobleman against whom the same Clifford soon afterwards informed separately, because he was rich. This was no other than Sir William Stanley, who had saved the King ATM's life at the Battle of Bosworth Field. It is very doubtful whether his treason amounted to much more than his having said, that if he were sure the young man was the Duke of York, he would not take arms against him. Whatever he had done he admitted, like an honourable spirit, and he lost his head for it, and the covetous king gained all his wealth. Perkin Warbeck kept quiet for 3 years, but, as the Flemings began to complain heavily of the loss of their trade by the stoppage of the Antwerp market on his account, and as it was not unlikely that they might even go so far as to take his life, or give him up, he found it necessary to do something. Accordingly he made a desperate sally, and landed, with only a few hundred men, on the coast of Deal. But he was soon glad to get back to the place from whence he came, for the country people rose against his followers, killed a great many, and took 150 prisoners, who were all driven to London, tied together with ropes, like a team of cattle. Every one of them was hanged on some part or other of the seashore, in order that if any more men should come over with Perkin Warbeck, they might see the bodies as a warning before they landed. Then the wary king, by making a treaty of commerce with the Flemings, drove Perkin Warbeck out of that country, and, by completely gaining over the Irish to his side, deprived him of that asylum too. He wandered away to Scotland, and told his story at that court. King James IV of Scotland, who was no friend to King Henry, and had no reason to be, for King Henry had bribed his Scotch lords to betray him more than once, but had never succeeded in his plots, gave him a great reception, called him his cousin, and gave him in marriage the Lady Catherine Gordon, a beautiful and charming creature related to the royal house of Stuart. Alarmed by this successful reappearance of the pretender, the king still undermined, and bought, and bribed, and kept his doings and Perkin Warbeck a TMS story in the dark, when he might, one would imagine, have rendered the matter clear to all England,